I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I believe uncontroversial fact that U.S.-provided arms should not be used to massacre civilians, should not be used to result in massive civilian casualties, and that is what we are seeing in Gaza.
As the official death toll in Gaza tops 40,000, the Biden administration's approved $20 billion in additional weapon sales to Israel, including 50 F-15 fighter jets. We'll speak to Josh Paul, who resigned from the State Department over President Biden's Gaza policy. Then to Colombia to look at how armed groups are increasing their control over rural areas.
Unfortunately, after a peace agreement and after an announcement by a progressive government to find total peace, I can say now that rather than total peace, what is happening in Colombia is a state of total war where criminal autonomous territories are being established. This is sad news, but it is what is happening now.
In Burma, up to 200 Rohingya Muslims were recently killed in attacks as they attempted to flee Bangladesh. We'll get the latest. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's killed over 40,000 Palestinians in Gaza since October 7th, according to Gaza's health ministry. Over a third of those, more than 16,000 Palestinians, were children. But that grim milestone is still believed to be a vast underestimate, with many buried under rubble and large numbers of Gazans facing life-threatening health emergencies. Among the dead are twin newborns, their mother and their grandmother, who were killed in an Israeli attack this week on Deir al-Balah as their father went to retrieve their birth certificates.
I was going to get the birth certificates for the children. My wife gave birth the day before yesterday. I went to get the birth certificates. I got two babies, twins. I got a call telling me that the house you were staying in got bombed. People from the neighborhood called me. My wife is gone with my two babies and my mother-in-law.
The babies were named Asser and Aysel. Their mother, Dr. Juman Arfa, a pharmacist. This comes as critical ceasefire and hostage release talks are now underway in Doha. More than 100 media workers, news outlets and press freedom groups are calling on U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken to immediately stop arming Israel. Israel's ongoing assault on Gaza has killed at least 160 journalists since October 7th, the largest death toll of media workers in any conflict, including World War II. Journalists, including Pulitzer Prize winners Laura Poitras and Spencer Ackerman, along with groups including the Courage Foundation, Defending Rights in Dissent and Roots Action, write in a joint letter, quote, Israel's deliberate targeting of these journalists seems intended to impose a near blackout on coverage of its assault on Gaza by providing the weapons being used to deliberately kill journalists. You're complicit in one of the gravest affronts to press freedom today, they write. The embattled president of Columbia University has stepped down after just 1 year on the job. Manoush Shafiq's resignation comes in the wake of her widely condemned crackdown on campus protests against the war on Gaza, during which she called in the New York Police Department, which violently cleared tents and arrested scores of peaceful student protesters. Shafiq said, quote, I have decided my moving on at this point would best enable Columbia to traverse the challenges ahead, unquote. She plans to return to the UK to work in international development for the Labour government. In response to the news, the Columbia chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace said, quote, the students of Columbia will never forget the sheer violence unleashed upon us by Manoush Shafiq, and we will not be placated by her removal as the university's repression of the pro-Palestinian student movement continues, unquote. You can see our coverage of the student uprising for Palestine at Columbia and colleges across the country at democracynow.org. In related news, five University of Chicago graduates who participated in Palestinian rights protests finally received their diplomas more than 2 months after graduation. The five graduates were notified that the disciplinary cases against them had been dropped. The students were never told why they were the subject of disciplinary cases. Democratic vice presidential candidate Tim Walz has agreed to debate J.D. Vance in a CBS-hosted debate October 1st. Vance has refused to fully commit, saying only he strongly suspects he'll participate. On Wednesday, Donald Trump launched more attacks against Kamala Harris during a North Carolina rally his presidential campaign billed as a major economic address.
To her left, I haven't heard that laugh in about a week. That's why they keep her off the stage. That's why she's disappeared. That's the laugh of a crazy person. We're not going to let this incompetent socialist lunatic keep breaking our economy for four more years. It'll destroy our country.
In more election news, the Washington Post reports Robert F. Kennedy Jr. sought a meeting with Kamala Harris to ask for a cabinet position in exchange for his endorsement. The offer was rebuffed. RFK Jr. reportedly met with Trump in July to offer his endorsement to him in exchange for a high-level public health position. A top advisor to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has denied a report in The Wall Street Journal that his government approved a plan to blow up the Nord Stream pipelines in September of 2022. According to The Wall Street Journal, a six-member crew of Ukrainian civilians and active-duty soldiers used a small rented yacht, satellite navigation, sonar, and seabed maps to reach the Nord Stream pipelines in the bottom of the Baltic Sea, where divers used an explosive known as HMX and timer-controlled detonators to rupture the pipelines, triggering a massive release of methane gas. The blast severed three of the four pipelines that carried Russian gas to Europe. President Zelensky reportedly approved the plan, but later sought to halt it after a Dutch intelligence agency learned of the plot and informed the CIA. Zelensky's commander-in-chief, Valery Zaluzhny, who was leading the effort, reportedly forged ahead with the plan despite Zelensky's U-turn. In Tanzania, senior opposition leaders have been freed on bail after their arrest alongside more than 500 young activists who were barred on Monday from staging a rally marking International Youth Day. Among those detained in the crackdown was Freeman Mbowe, a presidential candidate and leader of the Tanzanian opposition party Chadema. Earlier this year, Tanzania's President Samia Hassan lifted a ban on opposition gatherings that had been in place since 2016. But on Monday, authorities said they would not allow protests to continue, citing weeks of youth-led anti-government demonstrations in neighboring Kenya. The World Health Organization declared Mpox a global public health emergency after an outbreak of the viral disease in the Democratic Republic of the Congo spread to a dozen other African countries. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said the threat of cross-border spread remains high.
It's clear that a coordinated international response is essential to stop these outbreaks and save lives. A public health emergency of international concern is the highest level of alarm under international health law.
Workers with the United Farm Workers, the Union of Southern Service Workers, Starbucks Workers United, and others are organizing around the United States under the banner of Heat Week, demanding protections from extreme heat. Earlier this month, a 36-year-old sanitation worker in Baltimore, Maryland, Ronald Silver, collapsed and died while on the job as the heat index reached 105 degrees Fahrenheit. Meanwhile, here in New York, a climate protester was taken to the hospital Wednesday after a Citibank security guard punched him in the face while he was documenting a peaceful demonstration as part of the Summer of Heat campaign. Climate activists have been taking peaceful actions at Citibank's Manhattan headquarters all summer. Citibank's invested nearly $400 billion into fossil fuel projects since the Paris Climate Agreement was adopted in 2015. Half of Puerto Rico was left dark Wednesday as Tropical Storm Ernesto downed power lines and dumped more than 10 inches of rain on some parts of the island. Thousands have been left without access to running water amid soaring temperatures, with the heat index approaching 110 degrees Fahrenheit. the for-profit company operating Puerto Rico's grid, Luma Energy, said it was focused on restoring power to hospitals and essential services like water and sanitation. It's the latest in a series of power outages since Puerto Rico privatized its electrical grid in the wake of 2017's devastating Hurricane Maria. Despite the persistent blackouts, Puerto Ricans pay some of the highest electricity rates in the United States. And in Afghanistan, Taliban rulers held a military parade in Kabul, marching through Bagram, the former U.S. airbase, to mark 3 years since their return to power. The U.N.'s warned of a worsening humanitarian disaster in Afghanistan and a gender apartheid where women and girls have largely disappeared from public life. Meanwhile, Afghans are calling on the U.S. and Europe to release billions of dollars of frozen Afghan assets.
These billions of dollars that are frozen are not related to the Emirate government, but belong to the entire Afghan nation. The Western powers ruled over us for 20 years, did bomb blasts, and killed Afghans. They did not hesitate, and now they want to destroy us through poverty.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. Health officials in Gaza say the official death toll from Israel's 10-month war has now topped 40,000, but that figure is widely believed to be an undercount. We begin today's show looking at how the Biden administration has just approved $20 billion in additional weapon sales to Israel. The weapon sales will include 50 F-15 fighter jets, tank ammunition, high explosive mortars, tactical vehicles, and advanced air-to-air missiles. The State Department approved the sales despite growing calls for the U.S. to impose an arms embargo on Israel. In April, the majority of nations on the UN Human Rights Council supported a resolution calling for all countries to halt weapon sales to Israel to, quote, prevent further violations of international humanitarian law and violations and abuses of human rights.
On Wednesday, Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders appeared on CNN and criticized President Biden's support of Israel.
I believe that the Biden administration has been probably the most progressive administration in the United States since Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Biden said he wanted to do that, and I think he has kept his word, and Kamala Harris has been by his side. So on domestic issues, they have a whole lot to be proud of. But I think the president has been wrong in terms of his support for Netanyahu. I happen to agree with the International Criminal Court that what Netanyahu is doing in Gaza, the massive killings, the destruction of the healthcare system, the destruction of housing, the bombing of every university, and now creating a situation where tens of thousands of children face starvation. The United States, in my view, should not be providing another nickel to Netanyahu and his war machine. That's my view. President Biden disagrees with that. Do I think that will have an impact among young people? Among some progressives, I do. But at the end of the day, I think most progressives will say he is wrong. The president is wrong on Gaza. But the alternative is Donald Trump, and that is not an acceptable alternative. Mm-hmm. So we have got to keep pushing the administration to change its views regarding funding for the Israeli war machine. But we have got to defeat Donald Trump and elect Kamala Harris.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders appearing on CNN. We're joined right now by Josh Paul, veteran State Department official who worked on arms deals and resigned last year in protest of the push to increase arms sales to Israel amidst its assault on Gaza. He's a former director of the Bureau of Political Military Affairs in the State Department, where he worked for 11 years. He's now a senior advisor at Dawn. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Josh. Thanks so much for joining us. I wanted to ask you about this $20 billion. Now, that announcement came just after last weekend when the Israeli military struck a school with a mosque within it. Over 100 Palestinians were killed. And CNN confirmed that a U.S.-made GBU-39 small-diameter bomb was used in that strike, which resulted in, quote, over 100 pieces of people, as was described by one Palestinian journalist. They couldn't find a whole body intact afterwards. It was after that that the U.S. announced they would be moving ahead on $3.5 billion in military sales to Israel. And then a day later, announcing the $20 billion sale. Can you explain what this is all about?
Well, sadly, I think this is just a continuation of a policy that has been going on now for 10 months of the U.S. providing to Israel all the arms that it requests. The only difference is that for months the administration has been functioning with sales that have already been notified to Congress and so hasn't had to go back publicly. Now it has to go back publicly because it has reached the limits of those previous authorizations. I don't know how one looks at that bombing of the school that you described or the killing of the twin babies that you just described at the top of your show, or indeed at the Israeli government officials who are advocating for the rape of detainees and go ahead and provide these weapons and then look yourself in the mirror. It is a dark day for American foreign policy and a stain, I think.
And Josh Pohl, could you talk about the date, the time lag between when the weapons will actually be delivered? The Associated Press noted the weapons are not expected to get to Israel anytime soon. There are contracts that will take years to fulfill. So can the sale still be contested and even stopped?
Sure. So first of all, on the timing of the deliveries, the F-15s will take at least 3 to 5 years to build and will not be delivered until 2029. What is interesting in the notifications is that very unusually, the notifications also include delivery dates for the tank and mortar ammunition. The dates in the notification say 2026. That is the manufacturer's delivery date. Once the sale is approved, there is nothing to stop the U.S. government from providing these same equipment, the same munitions, out of U.S. Army stocks. And then backfilling itself as the supplies come off the production line. So I think that we could very well see some of these deliveries occurring within weeks. In terms of what can be done about this, first, let's look at the timing. You know, these sales have been pending for several weeks, several months in some cases. It's interesting that they come after Prime Minister Netanyahu's visit. That is a way, I think, of avoiding having sort of congressional action ongoing to try and block these sales while he was here. They also come several months before the election in the dead of August. And I think that that is also an intentional act by the administration to try and put some space between these sales and the friction that they will cause with much of the Democratic base and those upcoming elections. I think it's also worth noting, of course, that the one thing Prime Minister Netanyahu actually made a solid ask for when he spoke before Congress was for faster weapons transfers. And by giving him precisely that, the Biden administration is not only, giving Prime Minister Netanyahu again what he wants, but also strengthening Prime Minister Netanyahu's hand domestically, letting him show Israel that he can come to America, make a demand, and have it met. And I think that is extremely disruptive, not only to the pressure, or any pressure we are trying to place to push Israel towards a ceasefire agreement, but also towards that ceasefire agreement itself. Why should Prime Minister Netanyahu make any concessions when the U.S. continues to do everything he asks us to? Finally, yes, so there are steps Congress can take. Unfortunately, the administration has notified these sales during a congressional recess. There are 15 days until the administration can move forward with offering what we call the letters of offer and acceptance, essentially the contracts to Israel. Congress will not have returned in time to prevent that, but once it is back, Congress can introduce and the Senate can introduce joint resolutions of disapproval to attempt to block these sales. Those will not succeed, but they will prompt a much overdue debate on the Senate floor.
Also, though, the timing of this being right before the Democratic convention, where protests are planned for the Biden administration, well, that is President Biden and Vice President Harris, the Biden administration's support of Netanyahu with these Israel military sales. Why would they do this right before?
Well, I think that, look, first of all, there's no good time to do this from any perspective, right? I think that they are coordinating and continuing to walk a very tight line between demonstrating what will be, I do expect, a President Harris's continuing support for Israel while also trying to lean into arguments about the need for increased humanitarian assistance, the need for a ceasefire. And I think we will see the Harris camp speak more to those sorts of issues. But, you know, at the same time, President Biden remains the president, and this is his policy, and there have not been any changes to it.
Talk more about that, the ceasefire. New round of Gaza ceasefire and hostage talks are beginning today in Doha, Qatar. The talks are being organized by the United States, Egypt, and Qatar. Hamas has said it will not send representatives to the talks. A senior Hamas official told Reuters, quote, going to new negotiations allows the occupation to impose new conditions and employ the maze of negotiation to conduct more massacres. The talks are the first to be held since Israel assassinated Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh, who had been Hamas's chief negotiator. So if you could comment, Josh Paul, on what you think the significance of these talks are and the fact that actually Secretary of State Blinken was scheduled to be in the Middle East but has now postponed his visit.
Well, first of all, let us hope and pray that these talks succeed because Gaza desperately needs an immediate and permanent ceasefire. And while Secretary Blinken may not be there, CIA Director Bill Burns, who is an extremely capable diplomat, will be there. So I think we should all hope. At the same time, as you just mentioned, of course, you know, within the last few weeks, Israel killed the leader of Hamas and also their lead negotiator, Ismail Haniyeh. And that does not seem like the action of a government that is intent on recovering its hostages from Hamas's grip. You know, one does not kill the person you are negotiating with and then expect to achieve a ceasefire. So I think the odds remain very long. I think it also remains very much in Prime Minister Netanyahu's domestic political interest, as he sees it, that he not be seen to be making any sorts of concessions to Hamas. So I am, unfortunately, as I think most of us are, very skeptical that we will see a breakthrough. But let us hope that we do.
In a moment, we're going to be talking about what's happening in Colombia, but we want to bring Jan Egeland into this discussion with Josh Paul. Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, who is joining us from Bogota, Colombia. But we wanted to ask you, as you've long called for a ceasefire, and on this day, when the death toll in Gaza has topped 40,000 Palestinians, expected, in fact, to be far higher than that. Your thoughts on the U.S. right now approving, moving forward with $20 billion in arms sales to Israel?
Well, I must say, for me, as a humanitarian with lots of humanitarian colleagues on the ground in Gaza, I find it incomprehensible that the U.S. is continuing to provide indiscriminate weapons to an indiscriminate warfare in a place that where the population is trapped, there is no escape from Gaza, and where we are prevented from really helping them with sufficient humanitarian aid. There should be no more arms going into that place before there is a ceasefire.
Well, I'd like to go back to Josh Paul to talk about U.S. arms sales also to Saudi Arabia. The Biden administration has decided to resume sending offensive arms to Saudi Arabia, lifting a ban that had been in place since 2021. The U.S. had halted offensive arms sales 3 years ago amid public outcry over Saudi Arabia's role in the devastating war in Yemen. Josh Paul, your response to that decision by the Biden administration?
Well, I think it's just another example of the elevation of politics over human life. These air-to-ground munitions and the transfer of air-to-ground munitions from the U.S. to Saudi were, as you say, halted in the context of what have been tens of thousands of civilian casualties caused by U.S. weapons at the hands of the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. You know, we have seen no evidence to date that the Royal Saudi Air Force, if faced with the same context, would act any differently. Yes, the United States has worked to make the Saudi Air Force and enable them to be more accurate. But the big question is, would they be any more discriminate? And I don't think we've seen anything to suggest that the Saudi Air Force would act in a different way. And so advancing these weapon sales is really an olive branch from the Biden administration to try and keep Saudi Arabia on side as they continue to push this normalization deal between Saudi Arabia and Israel and this security pact between Saudi Arabia and the U.S. It's a sign that, hey, you know, please hang in there. We're still working on this. Unfortunately, it could very well come at the cost of future civilian lives.
Well, Josh Paul, we want to thank you for being with us. Veteran State Department official who worked on arms deals and resigned in protest over the push to increase arms sales to Israel amidst its assault on Gaza. He's former director in the Bureau of Political Military Affairs of the State Department, where he worked for 11 years, now a senior advisor at Dawn. Coming up, we'll continue with Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, about what's happening in Colombia today. And we'll also talk to him about Sudan, where peace talks are supposed to be underway in Geneva. Stay with us.
What is life? How do we live? What should we take? And how much should we give?
More questions than answers by Johnny Nash. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We're continuing our conversation with Jan Egeland, the Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council. He's joining us from Bogotá, Colombia, where he has been looking at how armed groups are increasing their control over sections of Colombia. According to the Norwegian Refugee Council, over 8 million Colombians live in areas where armed groups are operating. That's a 70% increase from 2021. Around 5 million Colombians remain internally displaced 8 years after the 2016 peace deal. The violence in Colombia has forced many people to flee the country, often by passing through the treacherous Darien Gap, which is located between Colombia and Panama.
In addition to Jan Egeland, we're joined by Manuel Rosenthal. He's a Colombian physician and activist with more than 40 years of involvement in grassroots political organizing with youth, indigenous communities, and urban and rural social movements. Has been exiled several times for his political activities. Rosenthal is part of the group Pueblos en Camino, or People on the Path. Jan Egeland, let's begin with you. Explain why the Norwegian Refugee Council, why you as its head, are in Colombia right now.
Because it's one of the largest humanitarian crises on Earth, really. And it's completely overlooked by the wider world. And it's happening in the midst of the Western Hemisphere. I just came back late last night from a journey deep into the Nariño rainforest. This is the southwest corner of Colombia, and met there Indian tribes that are at the point of extermination because of the continued armed conflicts between there are eight armed conflicts in Colombia between the many armed groups and also with the army. And there are all sorts of drug cartels that are fueled by the drug trade. So are the many armed groups. And the civilian population is in the crossfire. So I'm really shaken by seeing how many people are now completely unprotected in a widening armed conflict. Many of the unprotected, by the way, are also refugees, Venezuelans, migrants, trekking north for protection and on their way, they hope, to North America.
Jan Eglin, could you speak specifically about the impact of these multiple conflicts on the Amazon region? Deforestation in the Colombian Amazon has been surging, and some data suggests that deforestation in the region is 40% higher than it was last year as a consequence of the conflicts in the area. So if you could talk about the groups whom you spoke to there, the indigenous groups, and why it is that the conflict is especially devastating in that region.
It's because there is no state. They call it ausencia de Estado here, that there is no state apparatus, no state service.